Well, we're studying in 2 Samuel 15. I had to go home and look. It's been, what, 5 or 6 weeks since I was up here. Appreciate all the men who took my place during that time. I'm so rusty, I'm going to need a lot of help. So any comments you want to make, don't hesitate to throw those out. Just very briefly, by way of review on 2 Samuel 15, Absalom has shown that he has a great deal of skill at being a politician, deceiving the people, causing them to be in his court, though they know not one thing about his ability to rule. Not one thing. But he can make the people feel good about themselves, and as a result of that, he stole their hearts, verse 6 tells us. He asked David for permission to go to Hebron, verse 7, and then he turns out in verse 10 to let that be his base of operations for him to be the heir apparent to the throne. And he had these followers who helped stand by him. And then at that point, verse 13, a messenger comes to David and he says, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. He has stolen their hearts and they're no longer for you. And so David immediately says, we must flee or we won't be able to escape from Absalom. He knew what his son was capable of. And I find it a little interesting that David knows Absalom would not have been above murder or killing even him. You'll see that in the subsequent text here. He would have killed his own father and in fact makes that plan. And yet, you'll notice that Absalom, while he was willing to do that, David was trying every way in the world to keep Absalom alive and not let him be punished as he should. So you have quite a few emotions in David that are clouding his ability to judge as he should. So ironically, when Absalom in the first few verses of this chapter say, my father's not fit to judge, he's really telling the truth, but probably only as it pertains to his ability and willingness to judge his own son who deserved capital punishment for what he had done. More about that in due course. And then you'll notice as you go down through this text, the king is getting to the outskirts of the town. You have all the Kerethites and the Pelethites and the Gittites who come to him. At that point, and the king has these men who have come for refuge with David and to serve David and to fight for Israel, and now they have the worst of things. And at this point, they cross the brook Kidron, verse 23 tells us, and then we're ready for verse 24. Let me just give a little bit of a visual aid as we go through this. You had the campaign that David's son puts on, with the result that he steals the hearts of the people and turns out to be a great traitor to Israel. He's out for himself alone. And then you have also true loyalty comes, by way of contrast to David's son, to the Gittites and Kerethites and Pelethites who come. And their goal is to serve David the king and, by extension, of course, serve God and do His will. And then we noted that the little area here to the east of Jerusalem, the Kidron Valley, takes you up. Once you get down in this valley and climb up this hill, you're in the Garden of Gethsemane. So he's tracing the steps that Jesus himself would later trace as time would pass. That brings us then to what we see in verse 24. There was Zadok also, and all the Levites with him, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar went up until all the people had finished crossing over from the city. Zadok, of course, is the son of Ahitub, and the one here called Abiathar is the one whose father, Ahimelech, had been killed by Saul in 1 Samuel 21 and 22. And you have these two priests, Zadok and Abiathar. And we're told concerning them that Zadok and all the Levites with him, that they come to David bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. Just a couple of points about the name Zadok. In Hebrews chapter 7, you remember the Hebrew writer has broached the subject of Melchizedek in chapter 5, and he says, now I really would like to talk to you about Melchizedek, but you're just not able to hold to this meaty kind of doctrine. But I really need to talk to you about it to make the point about Jesus. Last part of chapter 6, in fact, in verse 20, he'll talk about Jesus being a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Then in chapter 7, he broaches this subject of Melchizedek, and he not only tells us a little bit about him, that he's king of Salem and priest of the Most High God, that he met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. That's Genesis 14. To whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all. And then he translates the name Melchizedek. The Melchi part means king, and the Sedek means righteousness. So he's the king of righteousness. Well, that same root word is what you have in 2 Samuel 15, verse 24 for Zadok. Zadok or Melchizedek. It's the same basic root word. And so there he gives us an illustration. I mean, he's also called King of Salem because he lived in the place that would later be called Jerusalem or Jebusalem, meaning peace. So here's Zadok and all the Levites with him bearing the Ark of the Covenant. Now, what have we seen before when the children of Israel were in dire straits? They're very scared. What do they do with the Ark and how does it turn out? Remember? Remember, I need a lot of help tonight. Oh, that's cruel. Oh, Joy.
They took it, Samuel's sons took it to go fight the Philistines, and they lost it.
Yes, they lost it. They thought it'd be a good luck charm. We'll get the ark out here. God wouldn't dare let his ark be captured. If you fast forward 800 years, Jeremiah talks to the people about the temple. And they said, there's no way God will let this temple be destroyed. It's his temple. It's where his name is. And of course, they were wrong on both counts. Well, here they bring this ark and they set it down. And Abiathar went up until all the people had finished crossing over from the city. And then verse 25, then the king said to Zadok, carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place. I see in verse 25, verse 26, verse 30, and verse 32, 4 points, if some of you guys are looking for a sermon, that we'll go over in just a minute. Let me just pass back quickly now, and if I don't forget, we'll go back over these in a minute. But you'll notice, if I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he'll bring me back. What's he saying here? That he's not going to use the ark as a good luck charm. As long as the ark's with us, we're bound to win. No, if God wants us to win, we'll win because we're with God and he's with us, not because we have the ark in our physical presence. And so he'll show me both it and his dwelling place. Like I say, hopefully more about that in a moment. Then verse 26, but if he says thus, I have no delight in you, what if God in his wisdom determines that David's going to die? David says, that's no less than I deserve. I've already deserved it. Let him do to me as seems good to him. More about that in a moment. Then verse 27, the king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Which is what they used to call the priests, the prophets earlier in the nation of Israel's history. He says, return to the city in peace, and your two sons with you, him he has your son and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. See, I'll wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. One of the most successful things generals can do in a conflict is to have eyes and ears on the enemy, to let him know what the enemy's doing, what his plans are. If you can get these papers describing what the enemy is about to do or find out some way their plans, you can counter that and be prepared for it. If you're caught off guard, you're very, very much in danger. And so he says, you go there, you be my eyes and my ears. And in verse 28, I will wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. Some versions have in verse 28, in the fords, the shallow water where they could go from one place to another crossing a creek or a river. So he needs these informers. He wants them to inform him, verse 28. Therefore, Zadok and Abiathar carried the ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. So they're going to do their duty. They thought they had a better plan. David says, no, we're going to do this exactly as God would have us to do. If he's going to save us, he's going to save us. He won't be because the ark is here. Verse 30, so David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives. We saw that on the map a moment ago. The ascent of the Mount of Olives, and wept as he went up. And he had his head covered and went barefoot. And all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up, weeping as they went up. It was typical in Oriental countries in the olden times, and even today, men and women all had no reluctance whatever to show their emotions, and grown men would cry and scream as loudly as the women would. And you see some of that here. And if there was a good time to cry, I suppose this was it. And in 31, then someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. Now that must have come as maybe a shock, maybe not, because we know the family relationship, we'll try to see in a moment. But it certainly came as bad news. Ahithophel is the smartest man in all of Israel. He is the counselor par excellence. There's no one who can compare with Ahithophel and the advice he gives to the general. He is among the conspirators with Absalom. You would have thought he would be too smart to be taken in by all these things Absalom's doing, but there's an ulterior motive on his part. And David said, O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. So here's the smartest man in all the land, but he's no match for God. He's no match for the power of prayer, and he's no match for the way this is going to turn out. So in verse 32, it happened when David had come to the top of the mountain where he worshipped God, there was Hushai the Archite coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. Now, this is the fourth of these things I wanted to look at with you. Let's go back to verse 25. One thing we learn in this very tragic time in David's life is, where is his trust according to verse 25? His trust is not in some kind of outward good luck charm. His trust is in the God of Israel. And so you notice here, if I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, it doesn't matter if the ark is here or if it stays in Jerusalem. The Lord is the key. That's a lesson for all of us. 1 Samuel 4, we need this ark out here and we're sure to win. No, you're sure to lose if that's where your faith is instead of God, because you'll be doing what you want. That ark won't talk back to you. Verse 26, a second thing. Not only are we to trust in God and not the ark, but verse 26, let him do to me as seems good to him. That says faith is willing to surrender all to God. Leave it all to him. However this will turn out, it is up to him to make that decision. It's my job merely to believe and to trust in him. Job 13 puts it this way. Job 13 verse 14, why do I take my flesh and my teeth? It's kind of like saying, why am I biting off more than I can choose? But he says, and put my life in my hands. Verse 14. Then now verse 15, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. I want to talk to God. I want to see why these things are happening. But one thing about it, I will trust him. And even if he kills me, even if this results in my death, it will never be the case that I stop trusting him. You remember Jesus, Matthew 26:39, not my will, but thine be done. And that's the same attitude that David has here. Let him do to me as seems good to him. My job is simply to trust him. All right, the third thing, trusting God, not the ark. Faith has total surrender to God. Then verse 30, David is in extreme sorrow. Sin costs. Don't ever think that sin is innocent, that it's minor, that it has no consequences. Sin is costly. Look what it cost Jesus. Look what it cost the Father. Look what it cost the sinner himself. And if he keeps it, look what it will cost him for eternity. And so here you see David having wept, having his head covered, going up barefoot, the people with him weeping. What caused all this? This all started with David's lust for another woman, another man's wife. Had that not happened, I don't believe this would have happened. This is part of the promise God made, that you have made a bed that you don't want to lie in. And it will be horrendous. You will wish you had 1,000 deaths rather than the rest of the life you're going to have to live. And he will say that when it comes to Absalom's death. He's not through yet. And then you notice one more thing in verse 32. When David came to the top of the mountain, in spite of all the negativity, in spite of all the downers he's experiencing, in spite of all the heartache, all the problems, all the trouble, all the pain and agony, he takes time and he worships God. How many would have said, let's put the pedal to the metal and get out of here. The main thing is get away from our enemy. He says, no, the main thing is to make sure we're going to maintain our relationship with God. And so here, before he leaves this place, he's still in jeopardy. Yet he comes to the top of the mountain and there he worships God. He reminds us of a Paul, as you see in the later books of Acts, Acts 21 and following, when Agabus takes the wrap and he puts it on his hands and he says, this is what they're going to do to the man who owns this thing. And they're going to take you to places you don't want to go. It's going to be horrendous for you. And these people are weeping and they're telling Paul, don't do this. Don't go to Jerusalem. Remember his response? What do you mean to weep and to break my heart? I'm willing not only to go to Jerusalem and be persecuted. I'm willing to give my life. I'm willing to die. I believe so strongly in the mission that lay before us. Well, that's similar to the thing you see in David here. So he says he's worshiping God, and then all of a sudden, apparently right after he finishes his prayer, I would assume, but it just kind of breaks off where he worships God, there was Hushai the Archite coming to meet him, which seems to be the answer to David's prayer. This is the man who will replace Ahithophel the Gilonite. The smartest man in the world will be thwarted by this one who's possibly the second smartest man in the world. And it's all because of God seeing to it that it occurs this way. So he no sooner finishes his worship and he looks up and here's this man who's going to go back. He's a servant. He's an advisor. He's a friend. He's out to help David. Matt, do you have your hand up?
Well, not to jump ahead too far, but God doesn't answer the prayer the way David worded it. He doesn't turn his counsel into foolishness. He
It was wise counsel.
Yes, it was very good. In fact, it would have been successful if he didn't.
It would have been successful.
The plans of the world will do you good if you don't listen.
If you don't listen.
That's what he did instead of what David did.
So instead of Ahithophel's mouth, it's Absalom's ears. And it accomplished the same thing. Yeah, good point. Any others? Okay. So a couple of things we need to examine here. You talk about the weeping of David. Why would he weep? Well, first of all, his own heir to the throne is leading the charge against him. How could you not weep when your own son is wanting to kill you so he can sit on your throne? That's a good time to cry. The hatred of his sons and others who now prefer Absalom to David, this debacle of David, this sin of his, has had this wide range of repercussions. It's like dropping the petal in the pond and the ripples just keep on spreading outward and influencing more and more to turn against David. The humiliation is beyond measure. David's sin is not only known by his people, but his sin won't go away. One thing after another keeps happening. Look at what happened with Amnon, who raped his half-sister Tamar. Look at what happened when Absalom killed Amnon because David did nothing. And it just keeps snowballing. When is this going to stop? The helper that influenced Absalom is David himself. He's responsible for all this. That's the worst part, I suppose. The helpers of Absalom are David's former friends. His counselor, the one in whom he had placed all his trust and had gotten the best advice in the world, is now advising his son on how to kill him. And that's exactly what he'll say. He wants to do two things. He wants to humiliate David, even as David has humiliated his family, that is the family of Ahithophel, and he wants to put him to death. He wants to see him put to the worst shame, and then he wants to see him put to the pain that will take him out of this world. And then the harvest of David's bitter fruit is the consequence of sin. Romans 6, what fruit did you have in that life you used to live? Romans 6, 20 and 21. Proverbs 1:31, therefore they shall eat the fruit of their own way, and be filled to the full with their own fancies. Well, that's talking about David. David's son writes this, and it could have David as the biography here. Jeremiah 17:10, I, the Lord, search the heart, I test the mind, even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. David knew quite a lot about that concept. You reap as you sow. Galatians 6, verses 7 and 8. The thing about a civil war, and that's what this amounts to, it's a short one, but the thing about a civil war is nobody wins. If David wins, Absalom must die. That's the last thing David wants. If Absalom wins, David must die. Now, which one of that dilemma you want to take if you're David? Do you say, well, it doesn't matter to me which one. It's pretty non-threatening. There's no good way out. There is no good way out. It's what they used to call the Pyrrhic victory when Pyrrhus of Epirus was fighting Rome, and he lost so many men, he defeated Rome. And they said, let's attack again. He says, another victory like this and we're done. It's called a Pyrrhic victory. So no matter what David does, even if David is successful, look at what it costs him. It's a Pyrrhic victory at best. Okay, now that's enough for that section. Any comments there? Okay, let's look at one more before we go on. This is the smartest man in the world. Think about this man who is an advisor to kings. He's acknowledged by all as the smartest man of all. We'll see that in chapter 16, verse 23. Well, let's just look at it right now. 16:23, where it says, now the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God. Now, what does it mean? These men would go up to the oracle of God and it would give an answer. Apparently with the stones, maybe one meaning yes, one meaning no. We don't know exactly how it was done, but in some way, it would give the answer of God. Should I wait here for the... Will the people of Keilah come? David had asked. David said, they'll come. Will they hand me over? They'll hand me over. They'll hand you over. So he gets out of there. God never gives bad information. The answer of Ahithophel, he says, is as if one had inquired at the oracle of God. It had an accuracy, apparently, of 100%. Not many men make that claim and state the truth. So was all the advice of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. And now that man is the right-hand man of the one who's trying to kill David. The smartest man in the world can be wrong. Did you know that? Ahithophel is the smartest man in the world. But he's as wrong as he can be. He's fighting against God. This will not end well for him. The third thing, he can be replaced. Hushai will replace him. Then he will dispatch himself by hanging and he'll replace himself. And then he can be defeated or overruled. Hushai is going to have a better plan, at least it's going to be assumed to be a better plan by Absalom, than the one proposed by Ahithophel. And when you're the smartest man, you're the best dog in the pack. And now here comes this other dog that you know is not nearly as good or as fast as you are, and now he's getting all the praise. That hurts. You've been number one all your life, and now he's taking your place. The smartest man in the world can be an evil man. He says to David, get out here on top of the palace and go into the concubines of David. That's pure evil. Now, let's get all together. I'll lead the troops. Let's go out and get David tonight while he's weary and weepy and tired and discouraged. We'll kill him, and all the people of Israel have no more reason to oppose Absalom. There'll still be just one king. David's gone, and all will be settled, and you'll be the king. And he was right. That would have happened. And you see how wrong it was on his part to kill David when that wasn't God's will, or to do immoral things in the sight of all Israel when that was not God's will. He can die in disgrace. You can be the smartest man in the world and die in disgrace. And many have. He's not the only one. And then you can die in sin having opposed God's anointed. Who's God's anointed today? What does Christ mean? That's the anointed one, isn't it? A lot of people oppose, in a far worse way, the anointed of God than Ahithophel ever thought of. Okay, any comments? Too few comments. We have to do better. Okay, you will notice in verse 33, David is speaking now to Hushai the Archite. And he says, if you go on with me, then you will become a burden to me. Now, that's not exactly what he wanted to hear. He's out here to help David. And David says, it's you. If you go, you're just trouble. But look at what he says. He's saying that would be misusing your talents. That's what he means. Verse 34, but if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I was your father's servant previously, so I will now also be your servant, then you may defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. You could be the most valuable weapon in our entire army. More valuable than Joab, more valuable than Abishai, more valuable than Ittai, more valuable than me, more valuable than all our soldiers. By doing this one thing, you go back, and this ability of espionage on your part, this ability to change the plans of Absalom will probably do more than all of us put together. This is incredible. So in verse 35, do you not have Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? You need any counsel or help, they can help you. Therefore, it will be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you shall tell to Zadok and Abiathar the priest. Indeed, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimeaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. So as Absalom is coming in, you get the impression that Hushai is coming in, and they greet one another as they arrive. Okay, Dave? It could be either. It could be either. I think if he just knows it, he'll know what to do by way of response. If he knows it and then gets it changed to a better plan, which is actually what happens, he's more talented even than David gave him credit for, is my opinion about that. But he will certainly take it. It saved him by God's providence. But yeah, good question. Any others? Okay. In chapter 16, when David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who met him with a couple of saddled donkeys and owed them 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. Who is Ziba? Where have we seen Ziba before? Yeah, Saul had a servant named Ziba, and he was taking care. Remember the fellow's name? It's a four-syllable name. Mephibosheth, yeah, if Mephibosheth has a health problem, what is it? He's crippled. He's lame in his feet. Sorry?
Since he was
5 years old, his nurse dropped him.
Jonathan's son,
yes. So here you have Ziba coming, and he's bringing all this food. It makes you wonder, is he bringing this food from Mephibosheth's land? Maybe. But he's casting his lot with David. And in verse 2, the king said to Ziba, what do you mean to do with these? So Ziba said, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on. So the donkeys, they're intended for Mephibosheth to ride, chapter 19 tells us. Mephibosheth, he wanted that donkey for himself, 19:26. But he says, they're intended for you to ride on. I know that you and some others can use these donkeys to travel and you won't be as tired. The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink. So he's wanting to score points with David. Now, at this point, the king says, where is your master's son? Who's his master's referring to? That's Saul. His son was Jonathan. This is his grandson, but note how they use the word son to refer to a descendant. It could be many descendants down, as in the first verse of the New Testament, Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Look how many are between Abraham and David and Jesus. Many. So he's using the word son here with reference to grandson. Saul had Jonathan. Jonathan had Mephibosheth. And this Ziba is in control of the grandson, Mephibosheth's property, helping him with it. He says, where's he? And Ziba said to the king, indeed he is staying in Jerusalem. For he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father, that's really his grandfather, to me. Now, several things about this are fishy, very fishy. First of all, who really believes that the crippled grandson of Saul has any chance at this kingdom? If anybody gets this kingdom, if David's knocked out, it will be Absalom. And if Absalom doesn't get it, there's an Adonijah who's waiting in the wings. We know from 1 Kings 1, he was plenty glad to take that mantle on himself. He ends up dying for trying a little bit too hard. So it wouldn't be this man anyway. And in how could David and Absalom's fight bring the kingdom to this poor grandson of Saul? It makes no sense at all. My view of it is that Ziba's lying and that David is taken in the heat of the moment, taken in by his lie, because in chapter 19 we'll see just maybe 3 weeks now, I don't know, We'll see that he'll, Mephibosheth will show up. He's not shaved. He hasn't trimmed his nails or anything. He says, where have you been? He says, well, I was ready to come. And he took the animals and left without me. And David says, uh-oh. So David says, well, you two just split what I've given Ziba. He says, well, if you're alive, that's good enough for me. Well, here in verse 3, he said, the kingdom will be restored to me. So the king said to Ziba, here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. And Ziba said, I humbly bow before you that I may find favor in your sight. The word favor there is typically the word translated grace. I find a problem, even if David judged correctly here, I find a problem in his procedure. What would the problem be? Here's a judge. He's made a decision. What's wrong with the decision he made and the procedure of it? What do you mean by that? No lawyer talk. Exactly. He just makes up his mind hearing one side. Proverbs 18:13. He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him. Verse 17. The first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. And that's exactly what happens in this case. When Solomon writes this Proverbs 18, is he thinking of his father and the debacle he made with reference to Mephibosheth? David is quick to think the worst of Mephibosheth. You mean he did that? You just take it all. He's quick to think that. He's very slow to judge Absalom. In fact, he's so slow he doesn't do it at all. And he's slow to judge Shimei when Shimei is throwing dust and rocks and gravel and cursing him all the way. Any comments on that? Anything I've overlooked? Okay, go a little further. In verse 5, now when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei. That will show you where Bahurim is. Oh. See right there. So just a little ways from Jerusalem. Shimei lives pretty close to Jerusalem. And this man named Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there, he came out cursing continuously as he came. He threw stones at David and all the servants of King David and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. Shimei said, thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom your son. So now you are caught in your own evil because you're a bloodthirsty man. Then Abishai the son of Zeruiah speaks up at this point. He has the same kind of hot blood in him that his brother Joab does. And he said, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please let me go over and take off his head. I'll take his head off so fast he'll have to look in the mirror to see what's missing. And so in verse 10, the king said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? Remember, we referenced that Sunday. What have I to do with you? What does that mean? We have nothing in common. Let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. God's in control of all this. I know that I'm worthy of punishment. That's what's happening here. Who then shall say, why have you done so? So he has humble resignation that whatever this man says, I'm more than worthy. David said to Abishai and to all his servants, see how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life. How much more may this Benjamite? Let him alone. Let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. So he looks at it from the perspective, if my own son's trying to kill me, I'm not too worried about this fellow trying to curse me. So at this point, he says in verse 12, it may be that the Lord will look on my affliction and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day. He's aware of his own sins. He's also aware of the mercy of God if he takes it properly. And he's aware that God will make it all right eventually. And in 13, as David and his men went along the road, Shimei went along the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went, threw stones at him and kicked up dust. Other versions, they cast dust. And the king and all the people who were with him became weary. So they refreshed themselves there. They have about a 21-mile trip altogether that they're going to take. Then 30-something more to go to Machanaim after they get word that they need to go further. Okay. Shimei's show and tell. What has gotten the bee in this man's bonnet? Well, he's brave at a distance, and he's great at talking. Well, we're going to see a little bit later, he doesn't have the courage to match his words. Now, if not for David, he would have died on this occasion. So all these things he's saying about David, if David said, Abishai, go take his head off, bring it back to me, and we'll use it for a souvenir, he would have been gone, and nobody could have faulted David for doing it. It was against the law to curse the king. In fact, you shall not curse, revile God nor curse a ruler of your people. Exodus 22:28. So what he's doing is against the law of God. It's similar to what David and Goliath did when they bad-talked one another, trash-talked one another. And so, first of all, what he says about David, he cast stones at him and his servants. You see today sometimes the Palestinians, when they're upset over something Israel has done, namely they're around, they throw rocks. Well, that was common back then too. He shouted, come out. That means get out, get out. It means good riddance, get lost. He calls David a bloodthirsty man. Well, these are lies and half-truths. First of all, 1 Chronicles 22, verse 8, God Himself says that David had shed a lot of blood, and that's why he could not what? Build the temple. So, he's close enough to the truth to make it sound good. David killed innocent Uriah, didn't he? David had shed innocent blood, and there had been a cover-up attempt. David is blamed for the death of Saul and his sons. How can that be? David wasn't even with them when they died. Saul's to blame for his own sins. And in fact, in 1 Samuel 24 and 26, there were two times when he had Saul at his disposal, once in a cave and once lying on the ground, he could have killed him and didn't do it. So how can he say, you've killed Saul and his sons? What had David done that you could twist to make it seem that he actually killed these? He supported the Philistines. Where did he live for all this time? With the Philistines. He was actually going out with the Philistines. So he can make that sound like David's guilty. Ishbosheth, in chapter 2, the son of Saul, died at the hands of two men who went to join David. Oh, how does that look? Guess who put them up to killing Ishbosheth? It must have been David. That's where they go. Overlook the fact David had them killed for doing it. Abner was killed by David's secret orders to his general Joab, chapter 3. Joab gets back and he calls Abner aside at the gate. He stabs him and he's dead. Remember what David did? He didn't approve of that. He mourned and he made Joab mourn. But by this time, David can't do anything right. Not if he's down and out and you're the one with a loud mouth and are going to let everybody know how bad he is. Shimei is a Benjamite like Saul. David must be thinking, how many Benjamites are just like this man? They think I destroyed Saul and Jonathan, and they're going to oppose me no matter if I win this war or not. All kinds of things must have gone in David's mind. And then finally it calls David a rogue, verse 7. Come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. That's a good for nothing. It's the word that's used of Nabal in 1 Samuel 25. It's the word that's used of Eli's sons in chapter 2, verse 12. It means a worthless, wicked, vile, abhorred, detested thing. Just good for nothing. So David, if he's as bad as Shimei says, then Shimei wouldn't still be talking. He would have been dead at the very beginning of this assault. Okay, any comments? Brother Dan.
Do you picture Shimei as maybe on a ridge?
Yes, he's on a ridge.
Parallel.
He is.
With him. So they wouldn't have easy access to just grab him. But then he could throw the dust and the dirt down and the rocks. And the voice would carry.
Yes, thank you for reminding me of that. I totally forgot. He's up here walking as they're down here walking. And he can throw it and he can kick it and he can act up. He knows they aren't going to rush up this hill and get him easily. He could run. He would run if he saw them coming. But thanks for the point. Any others? Okay, we'll plan the Lord willing to take up around verse 15 next week. Thank you.